Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson. This is another episode in my, at this point, very long series on David Graeber's book Debt, which I'm still not even halfway through covering. I had no idea what I was getting into when I started this. And I'm joined today by Fouad Moussallem, who is here to talk about chapter... I forgot which number it is. The chapter called Games with Sex and Death. Chapter six, Games with Sex and Death, which is a fascinating and troubling chapter. And I've especially am uncertain of how to deal with the anthropological evidence in it, having no training myself in anthropology. So I thought I would ask someone to join me who did know something about anthropology. So Fouad, can you tell us who you are and how you came to be sitting in this chat with me?
Sure. As you said, I'm Fouad Moussallem. I am an anthropologist by training. My relationship, I guess, with this book, and it's been really fun to get to go back to it for these purposes, actually comes through a kind of an oblique engagement with David in the first place as this kind of figure within kind of political activism in the UK in the like turn of the aughts into the 2010s, in the kind of space of student occupations and then what would then become Occupy as well in the UK, where with a number of other people who were involved in kind of student occupations, I kind of came out of one of them and got told by a friend, hey, have you seen this book yet? And I was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, this new book about debt. And I was like, okay, what's that about really? And they're like, you don't know this guy? He's been in all the occupations in London. I was like, well, no, I've not been in London. And so that was the kind of first engagement with David. As it happens then, as I continue to train as an anthropologist, I ended up doing my PhD at the London School of Economics, where then David joined. And I'd already met David a little bit in sort of some academic circles, some kind of activist-y circles, and then we then worked together, and I ended up being his teaching assistant for a while as well on the Intro to Anthropological Theory course. I'm sort of looking forward to being able to kind of talk about some of that anthropology, ethnography stuff with you. As an anthropologist, I'm an anthropologist of political activism, and in particular of the kind of making of political community in the Middle East, in particular in Lebanon, where I've done fieldwork with Lebanese political activists first, and then more recently with migrant workers sort of working in a fundamentally racialized sort of system of and labor regime in the Middle East that some listeners might know about, which is different in every country, but it's called the kafala, the sponsorship system. I'm looking forward to talking a bit more about some of the topics in Games with Sex and Death.
All right. I want to make sure we talk about the pitch that I gave to you was I wanted to make sure we talked about the TIV, the Lele, and the Nuer. I'm not sure how to pronounce those. We can worry about that later. Before mm-hmm. that, I thought we'd get into this question of ethnography and anthropology. And let me tell you what I think about ethnography and anthropology and Graeber, and then you can tell me what I'm wrong about. Which is to say, it seems to me that ethnography is probably a subset of anthropology. Maybe that's also already wrong, and you can tell as you go along. And it seems like ethnography is something that usually comes from very close observation of a culture that you are not a part of, and it leads to this sort of close reading of a culture. What anthropology is, I don't know, except a bigger thing that includes ethnography. But now let me turn it to Graeber mm-hmm. briefly, and then I'll get out of the way, which it seems to me, as far as I understand, Graeber starts off his career as an ethnographer in Madagascar. And then what seems to happen next is, in addition to being a political activist, he is an ethnographer, the same way you described yourself, as an ethnographer of political activists. And one of the things that he wants to do when he's occupying Wall Street is, on the one hand, occupy Wall Street, and on the other hand, study the people who are occupying. And then the place where he becomes famous, and I've talked to anthropologists about this as well, and they're, you know, both, you know, impressed with his work and somewhat skeptical of it, is he becomes a grand theorist, if you might, want to call, and the grand theorists can come from any field, whatever they are. They can be psychoanalysts like Freud, or they can be anthropologists like Levi-Strauss, or they can be economists like Smith. But they all sort of read the same texts and read each other, which is why Smith and Freud and Levi-Strauss and Nietzsche and these people from disparate fields pop up in this book, Debt, as well as these other grand theories. And of course, Graeber is both against the grand theorists, and not only is he a grand theorist himself, but B, the books of his that are not ethnography seem to be, you know, there's more Nietzsche in them, there's more grand theory in them than there is what I would call straight anthropology. And this has led Graeber to be widely read across the world. But also some of the other anthropologists I've talked to have said sort of the way people say Oliver Sacks, you know, that guy's not really a neurologist. He, you know, was trained in neurology, but he just wants to talk about William James and Freud, and he's just kind of an essayist. And it seems like we've got these two Graebers, maybe these two Graebers in these two different things. One of them is ethnography, a subset of anthropology, and then one of them is this grand theorist rising out of anthropology. That was my attempt. I'll stop talking now, and you can tell me where I've gone right and wrong.
Well, I was actually gonna wander along some similar paths, actually, in terms of the relationship between. Yeah, you kind of framed it as kind of two Graebers, Graeber the ethnographer and Graeber the grand theorist is how you framed it. I would actually think of it more as David the anthropologist, capital A, and I'll maybe get back to kind of what I mean by the distinction there. And you've for my money, framed out really clearly what are the kind of two ethnographic moments of David. So ethnography, very much the way that you've kind of talked about it, the kind of close observation, often invariably, particularly historically speaking, though not necessarily contemporarily, by a figure who comes from something other than the particular social milieu, if we're going to stick with society or kind of cultural context, depending on your kind of British or American flavor of anthropology that you want to go with, again, historically speaking, and kind of takes a look at the very specific particularities, right, of how people are interacting with each other, the things that they take for granted, the things that maybe for you seem strange but are familiar for people themselves, and can then make use of those observations as, if you like, a way to, if this is a further step that they're interested in, I think David is, to render the things which are familiar or taken for granted or deemed to be commonplace or inevitable or fixed about one's own context, render those strange or render them perhaps not so fixed and therefore potentially changeable, right? And that action, that would be the kind of the work of going away and doing long-term participant observation, right? Long-term field work in a particular place with particular people, right? And yeah, David has these kind of two long-term field work moments, right? The first is his PhD research in the sort of late 80s into the 90s in Highland Madagascar, which is then becomes the book Lost People, which comes out a lot later in 2007, though honestly, in terms of how long it takes for ethnographic monographs to come out, 15 to 20 years is not awful. And then the later kind of long-term fieldwork actually isn't so much Occupy that moment that then becomes the book The Democracy Project, right? But it's earlier than that with the Direct Action Networks in New York for the most part, right? And that, and sort of the alter-globalization movement more broadly, which becomes the book, which actually comes out only slightly after Lost People, Direct Action and Ethnography, right, in 2009. And those are the kind of periods where he does this long-term field work. And that, as a mode of writing, if you go and take a look at those two books in particular, don't really, for my money, don't really look like something like that, right? They don't look like the grand theory books. For a start, and this is the thing that's always really striking to me when I look at those books again, there are named people and they talk a lot. They talk a lot. And there is a lot of other people's voices. Now, of course, whenever you're talking about voice and authority and authorial kind of voice in sort of books, even those where there's a lot of other people, you know, of course, who chooses that those particular words come to pass. And the text is still ultimately the ethnographer in this instance, right, the writer David. But nevertheless, you have all these kind of other people. You have a kind of sense of how ethnographic evidence is produced, often invariably actually in dialogue between people and between people and the ethnographer, trying to make sense of what's going on, trying things out, and including the actual participation in the things that people are doing, which is especially kind of clear with direct action, right, of David actually being fully a member of these direct action networks, right? So that's for kind of ethnography as a thing you might do, and then also what that can often look like in writing, right? And often that's, if you like, much closer to the ground, right? You are extrapolating things out from ethnographic evidence, right? But the ethnographic evidence is the point. The particularity of any particular interaction is to the fore, and you are, the things you are saying are often kind of experience near or more experience near, right? If you wanted to make a distinction between ethnography and anthropology, right? And so the point is to try and make sense of a particular situation and say things about it, maybe some degree of comparability from it, but you're really trying to understand that situation. And then if you want to kind of divide that out and have anthropology with a big A, that tends much more towards these larger claims, these larger comparative claims over much wider swathes of human experience, historical experience, geographical experience as well. That's what Debt is, right, as a book. And Debt kind of goes much further than just anthropological evidence or ethnographic evidence, right? It's kind of bringing in a whole host of other things as well. But its aims are those kind of general principle and general kind of sense claims, including in some ways a search for origins, which I know you've talked about with Bill Maurer as well, right, which you can kind of find in Debt and some of the kind of other large anthropology works. So that's where the kind of grand theory maybe comes in. But I would suggest at least that the kind of grand theory you're getting in a book like Debt or The Dawn of Everything is still a very anthropological one, in the sense that it is making use of just an immense amount of different examples of stuff from a lot of places to kind of make these general comparative claims, right? Which are sometimes speculative, for sure. But in that, actually, I think we can see some other texts of this book is like. You mentioned some kind of other grand theorists, but within kind of anthropological traditions, you know, others have suggested the way that this book reads a bit like Fraser's Golden Bough, if you want to go back to kind of the much, much earlier period in time. Bill has also kind of separately talked about Marcel Mauss and The Gift, and I would agree entirely that a lot of the use of anthropological and historical and legal evidence in the book looks the most to me like a book like The Gift, which uses all these anthropological examples from a whole host of places, and then all this kind of legal history, which you get in particular the chapter after this, right? These kind of two keystone chapters in the kind of middle of the book, one more anthropological, this one, and then one more kind of legal, historical, which you kind of get in the next chapter. In these circumstances, you don't get a lot of David's own ethnographic material, right? Across the book as a whole, you get some mention of Madagascar, some mention of his research, his field research with, you know, direct action network and networks, but not really. That's not the kind of basis, right? It's other people's evidence, right? He is bringing things together. He is synthesizing all of this material to make these grand claims. And in that, he looks a lot more like the anthropologist historically, in a much earlier period of time, up to about the 50s, as a distinct person from the ethnographers or the ethnologists who are going and doing the primary research. Those were figures, often missionaries, often in kind of the kind of broader context of doing fieldwork in places which are colonial possessions of the country or the kingdom that you happen to be from, right? As sort of a Westerner going and doing fieldwork in Sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia, et cetera, et cetera. And then all those reports end up back in the imperial court where there are other people, Fraser being an example of this, right, who are collating all of this and then synthesizing all of this and making these grand arguments, right? In that instance, the anthropologist is just a different person to the ethnographer. And that's the mode that Det is written in for me, and the mode that a number of other of David's kind of, if you like, grand theory books are written in. But I would suggest that they're kind of grand theory in that kind of, in many ways, very old-fashioned way that anthropologists, as these synthesizers, these generalizing synthesizers of, you know, these reports of the ways that people across the world do different things, came to these kind of grander theories. And in that, I think it's somewhat distinct to some of the other kind of grand theorists that we've talked about.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The only name, well, I've got two names I want to throw out, but I'll throw out one first. So if you're going to be taught an anthropologist in a, say, critical theory class, if you're in an English department in America, or if you're in a geography department or a cultural studies department, the first one is going to be Levi-Strauss. And if I...
Who I didn't mention, but was the other person who I was going to mention. I think there's a large debt that David has, which he mentions a bit here. He mentions all over the place just in passing, but Levi-Strauss is an incredibly important influence.
And if I'm remembering correctly, Levi-Strauss, he goes and does field work and doesn't enjoy it that much. And then he writes all of his books in the anthropological mode where he stays at home, right? Precisely in this mode you're describing.
He does like 6 weeks of field work, but he spends a long time in Brazil in the sort of 1930s. He doesn't do extensive field work. He writes very, you know, in ways that have been very well regarded about that period in Triste Tropique, right? This kind of thing, which is kind of seen as sort of important literature, not just sort of anthropology. But no, all the things that Levi-Strauss is kind of famous and well known for, including outside of the discipline, are his synthesizing of other people's material. Yeah.
So the other name is, so my favorite anthropologist to read besides Graeber is an American named Clifford Geertz, who Graeber mentions rarely and always in the most negative terms imaginable. He says he was taking money from the CIA, which he may or may not have been. I don't know. He has one little aside where he's like, oh, and by the way, the whole cockfight thing, that was just caused by something some Europeans did 200 years ago, which I took to be a snide remark to be that Geertz had missed the whole thing. And I love Geertz. I taught Geertz this semester. I taught Geertz last semester. Graeber seems to me, if I'm reading this correctly, totally dismissive of Geertz. So I wanted to throw that name out there as well.
Sure. Dismissive, yeah, to a point. That's not David's tradition, I guess, is the kind of clearest way of saying this. And yeah, I mean, there are kind of political reasons for that as well. Yes, I mean, that particular kind of point that David makes is, you know, other people's research, if I'm remembering properly, William Rosenberry, I think is the name of the person, but I'm happy to find this, who kind of makes the point that actually the kind of cockfight in this form is basically a product of the extension of the market in Bali, which is a product of this kind of larger world system, this kind of wider colonial world system that is being put in place. And at least the version of this I remember from anecdotally from David talking about it was along the lines basically that the kind of market becomes a kind of a space, and of course the people in this context who are going to the market are women, and how can all these feckless men get their money on some of the kind of cash that the women seem to have control of otherwise? Oh well, I need the money, and I need the money because I need to go and have these kind of cockfights for honor, for kind of social positioning, and therefore it's really, really important. So can I have some of that cash, right? It becomes its own kind of way there, sort of jokingly to a point. I'd have to go back and read the Rosenberry itself to see if this is exactly what he's saying or just David's version of this, right? But fundamentally, it's a way within a kind of a patriarchal mode of extracting value from women who are otherwise the ones who have this money. And that's the kind of mode of the cockfight. Not to say that the other things that Clifford Geertz says about the cockfight aren't important, interesting, you know, worthwhile, but there's these other elements which David would sort of emphasize. I think honestly the other kind of distinction to be made with somebody like Clifford Geertz is Clifford Geertz did do extensive and long-term field work in a number of different places, unlike Claude Levi-Strauss, and unlike Marcel Mauss, who's the kind of other figure who we were mentioning, who also didn't do all that much field work, right? And instead, or rather, as well as that, was doing all this kind of work with other people's material. And in fact, both Marcel Mauss and Levi-Strauss make extensive use of Franz Boas's ethnographic writing and extensive, incredibly thick writer, as Clifford Geertz would then talk about it, right? These kind of thick descriptions, right, of a whole bunch of stuff, which was so full of material that others could come to it and do lots and lots of stuff with it, including a figure like David. And that, to a point, I think, explains some of the ethnographic examples that David goes to and goes back to, particularly this kind of mid-20th century writing, including the three key ethnographic contexts that are talked about in this chapter, right, which is Evans Pritchard's writing on the Nuer, the Bohannon's writing about the Tiv, and Mary Douglas's writing about the Lele, right, all of whom are kind of these sort of first half of the 20th century to mid-20th century anthropologists who also write these incredibly extensive and extended ethnographic descriptions about every kind of aspect, or certainly very, very many aspects of kind of social and cultural life, providing all of this material that then somebody like David could come back to later and write about. And you can see this too in David's own ethnographic writing. If you go and look at Lost People, or you go and look at Direct Action, David loved a long book, right? And when he kind of finally with Debt, I mean, he talked often about how he sort of hoped and expected that the value book from 10 years beforehand would be the book, right? In fact, it ended up being Debt, right? But you know, if you look at all of David's books, with the exception of The Democracy Project and I guess to a degree Bullshit Jobs, they're all like 500-600 pages long. He wanted to write those kinds of long books, the kinds of books that you didn't get to write anymore, right? But he managed to, by hook or by crook, happenstance or whatever else, end up in a position where he could basically just write these kinds of books that he wanted to write, both in the ethnographic mode and in the kind of anthropological synthesizing mode.
Yeah, that's fascinating and so useful. The only thing I'm thinking to say now, and probably I mean I'm going to draw us away from the mid-century anthropology that we need to get to, is I'm thinking, you know, so you said that Geertz isn't, you know, David's tradition. It is, in a weird backwards way, my tradition, is that I was trained by a Cavellian, and one way to think of Cavell is sort of like thick descriptions of philosophers, and the man who trained me, Larry Rue, one of the emphases of my entire training with him, and that was as an undergraduate, but I've continued this, is this sort of thing of like, you have to understand the people and their lives and how they understand their lives. And the worst thing you can do is use like high theory or, you know, history to sort of invalidate their lived experience. So one of the examples is, you know, in the 19th century, this is the easiest example, a lot of American Christians had explained to them that now that we've got the Dead Sea Scrolls, their Christianity is wrong. You know, the people at Oxford and Cambridge, as well as, you know, Harvard and Yale, discovered that Christianity was wrong, and it was time for them to just admit that they were wrong. And the tradition I come from wants to emphasize that this was centuries of lived experience that made sense and shaped a world for these people. And not only was it wrong to just say that, oh no, I found out that your way of life is wrong from a, you know, moral sense, it was also wrong from a descriptive sense. If they had a thriving community that provided them meaning in life, then that was the truth of their life. This seems to me the danger of the capital A anthropology mode, as opposed to the ethnographer, and you could apply the term thick description, which Geertz takes from his dissertation director, whose name I'm blanking on now, but is a colleague of J.L. Austin, who is the man who taught Cavell. So this idea of thick description of individual lives and communities seems to me the ethnographer's job. And then the anthropologist's job is to make sense of these thick descriptions without flattening them. And if you're going to do the capital A anthropology, it seems like you're going to flatten them inevitably. You want to flatten them as little as possible. And it seems that if that's a place that you can criticize Graeber for, but you can criticize every capital. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, 100%. And this is the kind of key tension, which in a sense, when these were kind of two different people, would be read that way, where you had the ethnographer or the ethnologist, and you had the anthropologist. And then when the sort of the de facto version of this became that you had the one figure who would go and do the long-term fieldwork and would then be the analyst, be the synthesizer of that material, that then became, if you like, more of an internal tension, right? Particularly in the kind of writing and where you wanted to kind of ground things, whether you wanted to emphasize an ethic explanation or ethic terms, i.e. material ways of understanding things that you from not the kind of space are bringing to people's experiences, people's social structures, people's cultural imperatives, what have you, or whether you wanted to privilege more emic descriptions, emic terms, the ways that people themselves understood what was going on, right? And this is always a tension, and it's a tension in sort of highly ethnographic writing, and it's still even a tension in the kind of capital A anthropological writing. The thing that actually ends up happening for the most part is that capital A anthropology exists less and less, right? With the exception of a few people, one kind of figure who sort of does a bunch of this is somebody like Jack Goody, right? Who wrote a lot of kind of texts like this, and David kind of, I know, sort of talked about and looked to as well. And another one is somebody else who David did look up to, explicitly Maurice Bloch, right? Who was also an ethnographer and anthropologist in Madagascar. Who then kind of did all this kind of, starts out as a Marxist anthropologist and then kind of becomes this kind of, neuropsychology, cognitive anthropology sort of person later on, and writes these kind of highly synthesizing capital A texts. And that's why that in many ways stands out. And it's possibly why, as the kind of, if you like, not actually the first foray that David tries with this, because it's actually the value book, False Corner of Our Own Dreams, towards an ethnographic anthropological theory of value. And I think anthropological rather than ethnographic is important there, right? The reason that sort of isn't really there so much anymore. And I wonder whether that's one of the reasons why, in the end, a book like that, including the kind of content of it, but also this particular mode, can be captivating, right? This kind of highly synthesizing, the sheer breadth of it can be intoxicating, along with all of that erudition, importantly, kind of put as these extensive footnotes, right? The sort of 60, 70 pages of footnotes you have at the end, where it can kind of exist as sort of a thing that you can kind of know is there as a reader without necessarily kind of delving into in huge amounts of detail. Dawn of Everything, similarly, right? It has a kind of a similar mode. That turns out can really work for kind of wider audiences in a way that other forms of anthropological and ethnographic writing, which are maybe not so readable, right? Maybe don't, right? And as I'm sure others have said, certainly elsewhere, and I'm sure in the kind of series already, that was one of David's genuine gifts, right? Was to be able to kind of write and write well in that mode, allied with the kind of the sort of brazen imaginative openness, right? And thought that you kind of could do this thing, right? For a number of different topics. You can kind of see that throughout a book like that.
Yeah, Henry Farrell, who was one of the critics of the book Debt that led to this famous internet argument about the book Debt with Graeber on Crooked Timber, his grudging 10 years later, a positive thing about that was that Graeber was a great writer of creative nonfiction. And, I had Henry Farrell on the show and I kind of pushed him on this a little bit because I agree that Graeber was a great writer of creative nonfiction. But I think Henry thinks that you sort of have to choose between like doing the real, you know, the real work that is sort of boring and esoteric, and the thrilling, captivating work that is in some way flawed or suspect. And I agree that the big works are flawed and suspect. I just don't think that writing a boring, dry book is any guard against being flawed and suspect. I want to disentangle those two things. You can be flawed and suspect in any kind of writing, but at least this one has opened so many people's eyes to so many ways of thinking and seeing the world.
Right, and I'm sure that neither of the Davids would quite agree with this sort of formulation framed quite that way, right? But, you know, I know that David Wengrow, you know, after David Graeber's passing, when he was doing the rounds, right, of talking about the dawn of everything, you know, and in fact, it's in the book as well, they sort of discuss the fact that, hey, you know, this kind of space of writing about the topics covered in The Dawn of Everything, all of these various just so stories, right, and myths of origin, right? One, they're all bullshit, but all myths of origin are bullshit on the strict terms. But the only bullshit stories that we have of myths of origin are these particular types, right? Actually, they don't work. And in fact, so the Davids suggest, we have more evidence such that we have for these other kinds of just so stories, or at least to kind of open up the frame and show, and I think this is a kind of key point of something like The Dawn of Everything, you know, that actually the sheer diversity of different ways that people could organize their lives and shifting back and forth between them, including within a lifetime, including within particular years of a lifetime, is just so wide that there's nothing necessary or inevitable about any of these forms of organizing, right? That provides a different, if you like, not just so story, or just not story, I guess, right? And hey, maybe it's important to have those four different kinds of political perspectives, right? Or at least to kind of open up the frame for different kinds of possibilities to exist. And that's, I mean, very explicitly is the kind of framing of The Dawn of Everything, and is there too in debt, though I think in returning to the book, actually, I think I'd remembered more of that frame being explicit in debt than it actually necessarily is. It's in like the first 15 pages, and it's in like the kind of final two paragraphs, basically the final chapter from my own reading, very explicitly. And then, of course, chapter 5 on communism, exchange, hierarchy is the kind of most expansive kind of space where you get some of this. Not to say that it's absent everywhere else, but the kind of explicit framing of it, I think is sort of very clearly there with Dawn of Everything, and they're here too, but maybe slightly less so. Either way, you know, they probably wouldn't accept it. I don't know if you're ever able to kind of talk to David Wengrow, that would be interesting. But honestly, from my reading, creative nonfiction doesn't seem like the worst thing to kind of call this. in terms of describing what work it's doing and what utility it has, right, in terms of particularly opening up kind of imaginative horizons, right? Which of course was fundamentally central to kind of David's ethos kind of more broadly.
Yeah, and that opening up authorizes all sorts of thick descriptions of people's lives that would be dismissed by, you know, someone who says, oh no, life can only be lived this way, and it's because of the barter system or something like that.
Right, and actually, I mean, just on that note, and this was something I'd meant to kind of say earlier when we were having our ethnography anthropology conversation, right? You know, a book like that, Dawn of Everything, et cetera, which of course is also, I suppose, archaeology with a big A, if that works.
Yes.
Right? But David himself, actually, in Direct Action, sort of talks about ethnography as in terms of the writing, ethnographic writing, as a way of helping a reader, if I'm remembering the quote properly, pass inside a different moral/social universe, right? Yes. I think that's a really good description, and certainly one that I found very productive, useful, helpful, right, of ethnographic writing. And in a way, that's, if you like, very emic, I suppose, right? In a way, that's sort of not what a book like that is trying to do, right? The discussion in Games of Sex and Death isn't to try and get you to kind of pass as a chapter overall into any of this, but the really, really long description of a number of things to do with sort of Lele sociality that you kind of have in the middle of that, which kind of goes to eight or so pages, he kind of ends it, and then immediately afterwards he says, the reason I've gone into this amount of detail is to try and give the reader a sense of what it is like to be a person within this kind of set of social and cultural contexts, the kinds of passions, the kinds of things that you'll be spending your time thinking about and preoccupied by, et cetera, et cetera. And in a way, you know, that's, if you like, him synthesizing somebody else's ethnographic writing, which is itself their kind of synthesis. And in this context, Mary Douglas, if you go to one of the footnotes, it's there, but David's saying explicitly Mary Douglas is this kind of Catholic conservative reader of all of these things. Who almost certainly, in fact, actively did disapprove of pretty much everything that the Lele were doing, right? And her Lele interlocutors were doing, right? But I think the thing that's interesting in that, if we kind of want to shift, I suppose, to what use David makes of other people's ethnographic material, I think this is one of the places where this depends really, I think, on your kind of your feelings about David's writing, right? Where it's either a sleight of hand on his part or just something that he takes for granted. And that is that he kind of takes for granted that he is doing things with this material that perhaps the authors themselves were not. And I don't necessarily mean that in kind of a sort of bad faith way. I actually mean it much more in a way that he is emphasizing aspects of, say, social art organization for the Lele, which the authors themselves are not, but which he's able to kind of tease out because of the amount of material that's there, right? And so the versions that you get from David of, say, the Noor is a really good example of this, right? You know, he describes in the chapter Evans Pritchard, the anthropologist who is doing fieldwork with the Noor in South Sudan, how they kind of lead him astray. It might even be in the previous chapter, right? But, you know, he wants to get somewhere and he asks somebody directions and it kind of takes him nowhere and he goes back and is like, well, why the hell did you send me over there? They're like, well, why should we have told you the right place to go, et cetera, right? And then what David adds to that is, well, maybe the reason is that Evans Pritchard's been sent there basically by the British Empire, right, by the kind of colonial office to go to Noor land to figure out stuff about their social organization. Why has he been sent there to do that? Well, years and merely years previously, the whole place has been carpet bombed by the British because of an uprising. And what the British colonial office wants to know about is this particular figure of the leopard skin chief, right, who he then does discuss in chapter six, or rather David here discusses in chapter six. Now, Evans Pritchard, you know, not necessarily a kind of a radical anti-kind of colonial kind of figure, though perhaps more so in some respects than others. You know, kind of pointedly, when he first kind of writes about the Noor, doesn't say anything about the leopard skin chiefs, right? Intentionally, and then does do at kind of a later point, right? But the point is, David is adding that further bit of kind of context to explain the particularities of what is happening here, rather than kind of treating this as sort of an obvious general kind of facet of Noor's social organization, giving us a little bit of the context of, well, this thing that perhaps even Evans Pritchard, when he was first writing about it, kind of writes as, you know, something ingrained or, you know, whatever about Noor society or Noor culture. Well, actually, there's very specific historical reasons for why, somebody in Noorland would not particularly take too kindly to this guy showing up who's very clearly been sent by the British as a British subject, right, to kind of find out information. Why the hell would you tell this person anything, right? And in chapter six, we get this, I think, really clearly with all the examples in a way, but in particular with the Tiv flesh debt, incredible kind of story about the kind of cannibalistic witches, right, which begins, and the way it's kind of framed by David in the first place is this kind of you know, just this kind of story, and you're like, well, what on earth is this? This kind of seems like this kind of highly, if you like, exoticizing, othering kind of story as presented. I don't know how you kind of approached it as the sort of non-anthropologist, I guess, when you kind of...
Oh, well, I can tell you that in the episode I recorded on this, I didn't mention them. Mm. I mentioned that I wasn't going to mention them, and I talked about the Lele. And then I started desperately looking for someone who could make sense of this for me, because I was scared to say anything about this. I thought I can't weigh in on this and whether this cannibalistic thing is a pre-modern sense of what could become slavery once imperialist colonialism is mapped on top of it. It frightens me. It doesn't seem that it's necessarily wrong, but I just felt like I couldn't claim that it was right either. And for anyone who's listened to that episode, which most people who are listening to this will have listened to that, you'll hear me say over and over again in that one, Graeber is saying. A lot of times when I summarize his work, I sort of adopt it. Like, so I can say like, oh, you see here that barter is a lie. But in that chapter, I say, so you see here that Graeber is saying that barter is a lie, because I'm afraid to even have those words come out of my mouth. I was so nervous. So that's why you're here.
Right. Well, so I guess sort of two things in terms of that example, which I sort of kind of honed in on, and I thought was a really good one to kind of try and unpack what David is doing with this material and the kind of way that he's writing about it. So the first is that in many ways, this is where I'm kind of seeing the sort of importance of a figure like Claude Lévi-Strauss, particularly, right? The kind of emphasis that Lévi-Strauss's structuralism had on myths in particular, myths and stories, for the ways that for somebody like Claude Lévi-Strauss, it kind of, it unpacked or allowed you to kind of see the kind of structured relations of oppositions that were at the basis of people's understanding and trying to kind of make sense of the world around them, right? That you could kind of, by doing structural analysis and kind of all the kind of complex technical stuff that entailed to these kinds of stories, you could get a real sense of what was really at stake, you know, which inevitably within a structuralist mode would end up being something like the kind of, you know, divisions between nature and culture, or, you know, what have you, right? The living and the dead and so on. What David takes, I think, from that is that myths and stories like this do have the capacity to tell you something fundamental, right, about people's worries and preoccupations, though perhaps not in a straightforward way. So in something like the Utopia of Rules, for example, there's the kind of whole more flippant version of this, which is vampires and zombies, James Bond and Sherlock Holmes, right? You know, and vampires and zombies, you know, I forget actually the kind of particular thing that he says there, what vampires and zombies are ultimately about, but it has to do with kind of silver and money, et cetera, right? Whereas Sherlock Holmes and James Bond are both the kind of quintessential hero figures of a bureaucratic society, right? That's his kind of ultimate sort of point, and there's sort of all kinds of fun if you're into this stuff. David clearly was, because he loves a kinship diagram and says so in this chapter, and he kind of does his own kind of structuralist diagram in the Utopia of Rules when he's talking about the Sherlock Holmes and James Bond version of this, right? In the case of the sort of society of witches, cannibals, right, he presents first this kind of extended description of what it is that happens here, where you kind of get and I guess I won't go into sort of detail, because you've kind of framed out as the David Graeber says version of this in the sort of other episode, right? But you know, you have these kind of figures who kind of come to you, and you kind of get invited to somebody's house, and then you eat some actual flesh, and then you're stuck, right? And you have to kind of keep feeding you know, your dependents and your relatives, and then ultimately yourself, to kind of feed this kind of flesh machine, right, until everything is kind of gone and you're burnt up, right? And so you get it presented as this is this kind of recurring fear or thing that's kind of said by a number of sort of Tiv interlocutors, right, to kind of various figures. And then you have the kind of 15-20 pages describing the slave trade in the 18th century, right, which is happening just on the edge of the kind of space that the Tiv are actually kind of occupying and living in, right? And ultimately describing these secret societies, this Arrow Confederacy, in which you basically have these kind of forms of debt and indebtedness that are required in order to kind of become a member of the Confederacy. And then you need to try and basically outsource that indebtedness to kind of others. And so that you are kind of accredited to others while still being indebted to other people. And you need to keep getting things from those who are your debtors to pay off your own debt. And if you don't, what will happen, you will ultimately forfeit on those around you, your relatives, and ultimately yourself, to the point potentially of becoming a slave, right? And being kind of sold into slavery, right? So in other words, I mean, his kind of fillip to all of this in this kind of unfolding mode of writing is that, well, perhaps it's hardly surprising that you have these kind of stories of these kind of witches kind of eating people and ultimately themselves being eaten up, because that's and not in a figurative sense, that's kind of basically what's happening right on the edges, right? Not so far away. He says 300 or so miles away. I'm not in a position to judge quite how far away that is in kind of social context, right? But his argument, at least, if we want to go with what David says, is that, you know, actually the story is telling you something fundamental about the fears. These kind of horror stories tell you something fundamental about the fears that people have. For David's purposes, that within these kind of human economies, right, where you have social currencies that are meant to basically tell you or stand in for the fact that there are certain things that cannot be bought or sold, right? And so instead you have this social currency that kind of stands in and says, yes, we know, so this is that instead. The kind of slippery slope, or the way in which that can actually turn, and for David, the kind of pivot here is extraordinary violence, the extraordinary violence of the kind of Atlantic slave trade in particular, right, can turn those social currencies into precisely the opposite, right, and ways of actually making human beings commensurable and saleable, right? And that this kind of pivots on kind of questions of debt, which obviously is the wider point of the book. And so this is a particular use of an ethnographic thing, right? This kind of story, this horror story, to try and unfold a lot of things about the kind of fears that you know, the TIV interlocutors of Agai and the Bohannans have, right? But the way that it's written is this kind of unfolding of presenting this thing that seems completely strange, and in a sense kind of incommensurable for the readers of it, who in this instance are not other TIV people, right, but the readers of debt, and ultimately coming to show the ways in which this, if you like, kind of makes perfect sense within the kind of context of sort of this, you know, extraordinary, you know, kind of genocidal violence being kind of unleashed in particularly expansive ways. And as he kind of points out with his kind of two key examples, so David suggests, at least, you know, the TIV are right on the outskirts of this particular kind of violence, the Lele are not. And so you have different kinds of fears, different kind of worries, which are kind of framed out in these kind of two different contexts. So, yeah.
No, that was excellent. I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me, though, is not how foreign these concepts are. Mm-hmm. But merely the, I don't know, sort of the thing overlaying them. So maybe the witches and the cannibalism is foreign, but the idea that you are surrounded by just a network of debts, that you owe everyone and everyone owes you something, and you have to make sure at the end of the year that it balances, this seems to me a pretty good description of modern Western life. And it's, you know, if you read Dickens or Trollope, it's a pretty good description of 19th century life. Everyone is always owing everyone something. Graeber's point, and this is, you know, the one, you've sort of answered this, but I'm going to push it a little further, is that this aspect of life, which is real for us in terms of our thinking, we're constantly worried about being who we're in debt to, and also real for us in terms of we actually, you know, lose our life, lose our house, lose our livelihood. You can still go to prison for being in debt in the Western world, even though we claim that we can't do that anymore. So we have this game of debt that is very real in our imagination and is real in our physical world, and it's violence that bridges the imaginary world to the physical world. Graeber claims, David says, that until the massive violence is brought in with colonialism for the TIV, this imaginary everyone is owing everyone else and everyone is afraid of being owned or eaten doesn't become, through violence, a real loss of life and freedom. And I'm just curious whether that account, first of all, if you think I've described Graeber's account correctly, and secondly, if that, you know, he's trying to get from the games that that the Lele are playing without, you know, too much violence, to the games that the TIV are playing with more violence, to the much, you know, totally un-game reality of the Atlantic slave trade. And he's suggesting that there's a continuum, and it's an ironic continuum, because, as you say, the games that the Lele are playing are intended to assure that this leap never happens. And I think he sort of argues that it never does happen for the Lele, that we can find them in the 20th century without having crossed this, but that doesn't happen to the TIV because they were closer.
Right. So, yeah, a couple of things, and it's, you know, kind of
also... By all means, I'm sorry. It's so...
No, 100%. So one of the things is, you know, the kind of, the way that David himself is also writing here of the Lele, the TIV, I mean, in many ways, this is a sort of a language that we, in anthropology, we just flat out don't use anymore. And again, for kind of many of the reasons that is there in sort of David's own descriptions here, though he's kind of treating it as kind of either obvious or not something that he kind of wants to emphasize, but because, hey, you know, what do the TIV think about anything, right? Particular people might do. And so, I mean, you know, just as one example, when we were teaching together, we would do this kind of exercise for the newer material with first year anthropologists, students, right, of kind of Evans Pritchard's writing, and then a whole bunch of later people who were kind of also themselves kind of critically engaging with Evans Pritchard's work and then their own research in sort of newer land, kind of making the point that, hey, well, it turns out it's actually, in this context, it's not so much of the Noor thing, but, you know, Noor with many cattle, i.e. people who happen to have a lot of kind of wealth, happen to have these particular feelings about certain things, and those aren't necessarily shared by other Noor men, let alone Noor women, et cetera, right? So, you know, but nevertheless, the writing in debt, and again, this was another thing kind of going back to it, which was sort of striking to me how much that's just sort of unexamined actually in the writing, in a way that actually elsewhere in David's work, though perhaps not anywhere near as much as other anthropologists, you know, that kind of writing is left as it. So that is kind of another kind of point, just as we sort of started talking, following David's own writing here about the TIV and the Lele and so on, though in the actual descriptions, I think you get a lot more kind of, if not any particular Lele person or TIV person saying anything about this, at least sort of more kind of differentiation of different people's perspectives in these kind of contexts. So I guess that's for one. I think the use of the language of games for the title of the chapter, given that it's not really referenced in the chapter itself all that much, has kind of left me thinking a little bit, right? Because I'm not so sure that any of the games, such as they are in this chapter, aren't serious, if you like. And, you know, games are incredibly important for David more broadly, you know, as a kind of imaginative space where you can kind of make sense of things, again, figure out different possibilities, different opportunities. So perhaps the game being played in this chapter is by David himself, bringing all these things together rather than necessarily games which any of the kind of particular groups of people being discussed are kind of playing, though I have as much of a sense of that as you do. I'm not really sure kind of what's going on there. In terms of the ethnographic examples that David is using in this chapter, and which he kind of often goes to, right, the kind of contexts are either stateless context, stateless societies, acephalous societies, right, in which you don't have a kind of a state, or groups of people on the edges or the outskirts of state/market kind of contexts, right? And you kind of have, if you like, both of those things covered here between the Lele and the TIV material, and then the kind of final 5 or 10 pages where he sort of makes this point of like, this isn't a thing only about sub-Saharan Africa in the 18th century and sort of the slave trade, actually you can kind of see similar things going on in, you know, kind of Southeast Asia, Bali, Indonesia, in kind of colonial context, right? Again, another kind of context in which you have sort of a market kind of system and groups on the edges of it having to interact with it. And that's a kind of space where some of this kind of tension comes into being. So that's the story with the sort of TIV context, right? Being on the edge of and being harried by these kind of slave raiding and slave trading kind of contexts, right? But the one thing I kind of add to your reading of the Lele material, at least, is that in his own rendering of this, there is a violence, right, if you like, within the kind of context too, right? And that is the kind of violence, which again, in many ways, is kind of skirted over and presented just as it is, and is kind of brought up in more directly, if not more explicitly, in the next chapter, which is the kind of violence perpetrated on women, right? And that is the kind of context of violence, and he kind of states that the kind of one context in which war takes place between different, you know, kind of violent conflict takes place between different villages is over women, right? And the kidnapping of women one way or the other. That's the thing that can kind of bring people together, and people here rendered men together to fight with one another, right? Is in that kind of a context. And so there is, if you like, violence internal to that as well. But yeah, it's sort of, it's if you like, at least rendered the way that David does in the chapter. It's a kind of a violence which is part of the kind of broader system, right? Rather than one which is destroying kind of sets of kind of social cultural logics and perspectives from outside. Those are simplifications, right? But they're David's simplifications too, in terms of the way that he's reading this material.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense, and I've kept you longer than I meant to already. I guess the games thing for me, mm-hmm. and listeners to this podcast know that I've been teaching and working on games, including Graver's use of games. It seems to me that what he is saying is, if you look at the Lele, it looks like they are trading people, like Pokemon cards. And if they're trading people like Pokemon cards, then it looks like they're doing slavery, like the Atlantic slave trade. But if we look closer, they're actually trading people like Pokemon cards. Pokemon cards are treasured. They are loved. They're not harmed. And everyone sort of, and the additional thing is that everyone in this system is a Pokemon card. So you're actually trading yourself, and you're owned seven times over. And even though it is deeply important, as games are, it's also not a matter of life and death. And it's only when the Europeans show up where the trading becomes a matter of life and death. And then, in fact, everything about the trading, as he's reading it, or as he's reading these ethnographic descriptions, actually goes away. And all that's left is the trading of lives in this purely mechanistic and economic way, which makes it nothing like the trading of Pokemon cards anymore, even if from an outside perspective, without an understanding of human economy and with a narrow Adam Smith influenced view of what it means to trade something, we would miss it entirely. It's a game that is so real in its gameness, but never real in its violence, except he says occasionally. With the Lele, at least, he says occasionally. With the Tiv, he says, and it much more often, which he attributes, again, I think, with proximity. I mean, it's not, I don't know, we're not going to solve this. This is so thorny, but I wanted to say that one last thing. And if you have time, please respond. And if you have to go.
I have time. Yeah, I think this is I listened to sort of the last episode, which has kind of gone up, where you kind of talk about your back and forth with Simona. And I think that this kind of one of your listeners. And I think this kind of gets to sort of the kind of heart of part of that conversation too, which is, part of, to the degree that there's a search for origins going on of a particular kind in this book. And I think you can kind of see a version of that going on in this chapter, right? About the kind of the place, the moment here in a particular historical moment, but more broadly where what David here calls, following another anthropologist, Keith Hart, calls human economies, kind of interact with market economies and therefore kind of fundamentally shift from being about the kind of production of humans, right? And production, another thing being about that, to instead the kind of production of capital, of sort of non-social wealth, money, et cetera, right? Now, of course, one way you could read that is, well, prior to that, things are hunky-dory and working kind of great in these kind of other places, and potentially there's a reading that can be done here in this chapter of that with some of the kind of material. But I think one of the reasons why you have this kind of super extended kind of 12 pages or whatever it is, of kind of describing Mary Douglas's material about the Lele, again, David's reading of, Mary Douglas's reading of, is to kind of show all the ways in which, hey, this kind of works well for a number of people in this kind of context, including maybe some Lele women who then, and here he does just kind of quote Mary Douglas herself, kind of talking about how young Lele women can grow up quite coquettish, which is incredibly laden language from Douglas, just repeated by David, though, in Douglas's own words. But it also shows the ways in which actually there's huge amounts of violence going on in here as well. That, none of these are kind of perfect kind of context of sort of freedom and autonomy, including, if we're kind of going to take the sort of feminist and in particular kind of Marxist feminist lens, which, and here David's citational politics are kind of all over the place, honestly, and elsewhere, talking about some of these ideas as he does in sort of other places, he's much more explicit about his indebtedness in these readings of things to particularly Marxist feminist anthropologists, though here it's just absent entirely. The kind of broader context here is one where, hey, this might work kind of in terms of sort of freedom and autonomy, even rendered in kind of a particularly kind of anarchist frame for men, but not necessarily for women, right, in these kind of a context. So I think that material is there here as well. And so that kind of, the one thing I wanted to make sure to kind of at least touch upon with this kind of aspect of things is that my kind of feeling on sort of David as an anthropologist, I guess, capital A, but also David as an ethnographer, is that one of the kind of guiding perspectives for me is that the central motivation for me is to reject inevitability, right? He is against inevitability. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the things that have come to pass elsewhere are necessarily better. And The Dawn of Everything does this really explicitly again, but you can kind of find it elsewhere too. His emphasis on imagination and possibility and all these kind of other ideas too. The point is much more just to kind of over and over again, just to make the point that, hey, things have been different in any number of ways in different places and different times, and therefore they can be different moving forwards too. There is nothing inevitable about the structures and the forms that things have taken. I think for me, that would be the kind of spirit to take the use of ethnographic material here, and more broadly in a lot of anthropology, here, small a anthropology, I guess, here I'm sort of talking about anthropological writing more broadly rather than the kind of grand theory stuff necessarily. But I think that's a kind of a motivation that it's possible to find sort of everywhere, or in certainly very many places in David's writing more broadly, and in the writing of some many others too, right? This kind of attempt to sort of not take for granted that things have ended up this way, or rather to not make it seem inevitable that we've ended up in this particular kind of place. And to the degree that we want to kind of see, one of the reasons behind the kind of search for origins that's going on in Debt and some other kind of places, I think my own kind of reading of it would be that, other readings are definitely available, right? I think David is very interested in origins for origins' sake. But I think one of the other ways that something like that, Dawn of Everything and other of these kind of texts can be taken is that just by showing the fact that the kind of the just so stories that we might have otherwise are myths, that other myths might be possible, and that there's other material to build those myths in the human record, you know, historically, contemporarily, you know, in different contexts, at the edges of contexts we might know, you know, and here the kind of activist material of direct action is a good example, right? You know, you don't necessarily have to go very far away from where you might find yourself if you're a Western reader, right? Or you're a reader in the US, say, you know, hey, go find the kind of people who are doing different things and join up, right? I think that's the kind of imperative you can take from some of these kind of wider stories about the deep past, you know, alongside the kind of anthropological material contemporarily, is so many different ways of organizing the world, your life, etc., are possible, good and bad. None of them are inevitable. Figure out the ways that they could be different.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And I've been doing that in this podcast, and, you know, I've received criticism like, oh, you make Athenian democracy sound so wonderful. What about the slavery, the misogyny, and the imperialism? And the answer is, you know, there's no defense. There's no defense of those things. The tricky thing is to find the other ways of organizing life that one admires and elucidate what one admires about them without accepting all of the bad stuff that comes with them, which is easy to do, to not accept it. But I think it's much harder to enumerate these other ways of life that one might admire without saying over and over again, oh, and of course also it was bad that there was slavery in this culture. And that becomes very tedious. I couldn't say that over and over again every time I talked about what I liked about what I might like about ancient Rome. But then someone who is not a receptive listener is going to listen and just be like, this is a guy who wants to live in ancient Rome, which was a horrible place run by elites and violence. And I think that's roughly Bill Maurer's take, at least on some of this stuff from Graeber, is that Graeber is taking all the good stuff and presenting it like these are almost utopian societies when there's all the bad stuff as well. And Graeber does the same thing I do, which is say, and I know there's lots of bad stuff and it's there, I promise. He doesn't spend his time on it, and I know why, but I also think that opens him up to this critique. And I say that as someone who is following Graeber's method and am receiving the same critiques. I've taken so much of your time now. Anything else you would like to say, Fouad, before we go?
No, that all seems great to me. It's been really fun to get to spend more time with some of David's work that I must admit I've not gone back to as much as some of his kind of other kind of work. But yeah, it's been a fun conversation. Thanks for having me on.